Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios, New York City. I welcome you. Today, an empowering hour. The latest on cacao, carob, cocoa, the different forms of chocolate, and trying to give you an understanding of what they are, but they're all good. In fact, the newest statement is that the chocolate industry could save about $30 billion a year that we're spending in statins. I'll explore that. Also, kale. Now, I'm sure many of you have tried kale. I grew up in the South. We love kale. We use it generally stir-fried with onions or garlic or both, and it's a wonderful side dish. But then you've probably eaten it in the dry form, the dehydrated form, with all the different kind of vegan cheeses on it. It's delicious. I'll tell you about kale. Also, there's a lot of information coming out about tulsi plant, which is holy basil, and it can help remove fluoride from our water and support the pineal gland. I'll give you the latest on that. And there's also Ayurvedic copper practice supporting what it does to the superbug infection research. And what's one of the ways men can end up being more vulnerable to having an enlarged prostate or even cancer the prostate? I'll tell you about that. From our environmental segment today, what it's like to have fracking in your backyard. There is an article that I'll be sharing with you today on this very topic by Tara Lohan and from Alternet. Then, in another area we're going to talk about, environmental issues, the San Onofre area with the nuclear power plant out in California, whistleblower says that there's a potential catastrophic failure in the design there. So for all of the people listening right now in KPFK and have been for the last 30 years, I'll give you the latest on that. And from our public health segment, if time permits, you are a guinea pig. How Americans became exposed to biohazards in the greatest uncontrolled experiment ever launched by David Rossner and Gerald Markowitz from Tom Dispatch. As you see, we have a lot to share, so let's begin. Right at the top, let's be aware that organic chocolate without the processed sugars or the dairy is a superfood. You don't have to have a lot of it, 1 or 2 ounces. That's about the amount that would fit into a tablespoon. That's all. Is enough to give your heart a big boost. It can lower your cholesterol. That's good. It can thin your blood. That's even better. That helps prevent stroke. But this newest work, according to Bayer Sayer G of GreenMed Info, it can also compete against the statin drugs. And we know that the statin drugs are the primary drugs used for cardiovascular events. And I'm opposed to them because I know there are natural ways of dealing with the conditions and also their deadly side effects. There are over 300 different documented adverse health effects, including heart failure, from using statin drugs. There are no side effects, but only good things, from using natural chocolate. Now, we use about 6 billion pounds of cacao consumed, that's C-O-C-O-A, worldwide. And yes, we love the taste of it. And yes, it makes us feel good because it will impact a hormone-stimulating effect upon the brain. But eating this chocolate is inversely related with blood pressure. There is a 15-year cardiovascular all-cause-of-death study, and here's what it says. When compared with the lowest 33% of cacao intake, the adjusted relative risk for men, and the highest percentage for cardiovascular death, or 50% reduction of 53% reduction of all-cause death. And so in lay language, what this study is saying, it was, quote, as little as 2.1 grams per day. Now, 2.1 grams, it takes 28 grams to make an ounce. So you're dealing with about, what, 1/14th of an ounce? That's a tiny percentage of a teaspoon. That's nothing. And yet it had that impact. So if you were to eat the chocolate each day, you would have upwards of a 47% in the higher group reduction in death from cardiovascular and all cause. Quote, anything that can reduce your risk of dying from all causes by 50%, which is not expensive and is not dangerous, should be taken seriously. Paradoxically, it's usually found in the candy section of the grocery store. There's no shortage of solid human clinical research supporting the consumption of raw chocolate. It reduces the LDL. It increases the HDL. It helps stabilize insulin. It is important for endothelial function. It can help reduce hypertension and stroke. So there are at least 30 major studies showing how raw chocolate or cacao is important for us. And that is our tip of the day. So, by the way, I've even seen good quality studies that chocolate can also extend the overall lifespan. It has metal chelating properties, antioxidant properties. It can protect against Alzheimer's. Why? Because cacao has procyanidins, which attenuate lipid peroxidation associated with neuron cell death. It can reduce stress, elevated catecholamines. That's about 40 grams, or just over maybe an ounce and three quarters of chocolate. During a two-week period, reduce the excretion of cortisol and catecholamines, and while reducing other metabolic indicators of stress. It also helped the gut microflora. It inhibited cholesterol oxidation. It boosted cognitive performance. And mind you, the very same type of chemical you find in red wine and green tea that boosts cognitive performance, you also have in the raw chocolate. It inhibited cancer. Limited, yes, but significant research indicates that cacao is capable of inhibiting certain types of cancer, and the growth of prostate cancer cells have been selectively inhibited with cacao polyphenols, and it improves diabetes. In fact, an article in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition revealed that the consumption of chocolate, especially the cacao, the raw, versus regular chocolate, which has been heated, the flavin 3 alls, the flavan, F-L-A-V-A-N, number 3, O-L-S, that reduces the broad range of risk factors for cardiovascular disease, including insulin resistance. And there are 42 acute long-term studies. The average improvement was 33% in insulin resistance. That's terrific. So that helps with that. And it also boosts sexual function. It's a great vasodilator, which is one reason why it has been traditionally linked to improving fertility and virility. Chocolate consumption allows a higher sexual function in women also. So take a look. It's great. Now, when I suggest people use green food in compounding powders each day, in part it's because not everyone has the availability of having fresh certified organic produce where they can go to a farmer's market or a food co-op. You've got, you know, some great food co-ops. The Brooklyn co-op is terrific. The Flatbush food co-op, two of the oldest, largest in the New York metro area, but every town has food co-ops and farmers markets. But not everything is available 12 months a year. And therefore, buying organic frozen is also good. And when it comes to the fruits, you can now buy concentrates. For example, it's very hard to get tart or Montmorency cherries, except only for about 3 weeks a year. But it's easy to get the concentrate. Now, concentrates, in my opinion, are just super. Why? Because they're boosters. They will take the cherries or the blueberries or the papaya and they juice them. Then they siphon off anywhere from 20 to 50% or more of the water. The more water they siphon off, the greater the concentration. Generally becomes very thick, hence it pours very slow, but that's good, because you're getting two or three or four times the amount of the actual healing nutrients. And that's available all the time. And then, best of all, are the powders, because then the juice is dried, so you lose nothing. You simply lose the water and concentrate all the nutrients. I once did an estimation. I haven't done it for a while. But I was on the road, and I was filming every day. And more often than not, I was driving long hours. I remember I drove from Miami, actually Key West, to Miami. I filmed there, drove across Alligator Alley, up through the state, stopped off in Tampa, filmed there, drove up through the panhandle, which was another 6 hours to get out of Florida. Florida's a long state, longer than New York State. And then went across Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and finally filmed down in Texas. Well, that takes a lot of effort. And outside of getting gasoline, I'm just driving and I have a little microphone into the dashboard, so I dictate, so I write. I get in a stream of consciousness, so I write articles, commentaries, chapters of books. And then when I get to a place I can mail it off, I send them off, and then it's transcribed. But trust me, you can't find a lot of restaurants. At least I can't find restaurants that I can find something to eat in. So I always take a cooler, and I fill it up with some things that won't go bad, like potatoes, organic potatoes and beans. And sometimes I'm able to find a restaurant that will allow me to do my own cooking. More often than not, I will give it to them and pay them for their most expensive meal, which is generally not expensive, $20, $25, and they'll cook a meal. And after all, I argue with them in a pleasant way. I say, well, look, this is 100% profit because you're not giving me any of your food. Plus, you're making the money off your most expensive meal. So generally, it works out pretty good. But then I have long stretches where that doesn't work. So that's where I rely upon taking things that are bottled and or in powder form, adding water. I estimate that I consume on those trips about 100 plus pounds of fruits and vegetables per day. It's just that I can't eat more than as anyone could, anywhere from 1 to 2 pounds of fruits and vegetables in a given day, because you've got so much fiber and they're heavy in water. But when you realize how many vegetables it takes to make a single ounce of powder and how much you have to juice, so try this sometime, just for the fun of it. Get yourself a big bag of parsley and kale and collard greens. Collard greens you generally buy in a huge bunch, and they're inexpensive. And then juice it, and see how much you have to juice before you get a quart of juice. Then take 75% of that away, and that's what you're left with as a powder. Actually, excuse me, 97% away. And then you get an idea of how much it takes. but you're getting the full nutrient. And that's why the super potentizing of the cell, the super healing of the DNA, the benefit of helping correct DNA defect comes from concentrate. So the more you have, the better it is. And the same thing with spirulina. Now, this is the latest study on spirulina, because spirulina, you just can't go and buy fresh spirulina. It's a microalgae. But you can certainly get it under a gazillion different brands out there. Just get it organic. This is the latest study, and this comes from the School of Pharmaceutical Sciences. Quote, spirulina can help type 2 diabetes patients manage their blood sugar levels, among other benefits. Now, we know that spirulina is blue-green algae. It's also known as a cyanobacteria. It's native to Africa, Asia, and Central America, and it's been studied and used for at least the last 400 years. Today, I suggest it for people who have AIDS, allergies, cancer, cardiovascular disease, any form of immune dysfunction or infections. But it's also used for diabetes. It has a really good impact upon decreasing excess blood sugar, reducing cholesterol and triglycerides, and it's just terrific for you. So if you are overweight or if you have an elevated cholesterol, think now about the power of a simple nutrient that is so good for you. Spirulina. S-P-I-R-U-L-I-N-A. Spirulina. Now, one other green is kale. Now, kale is really good. Tastes great, especially when it's dried, and they can dry it at 115 degrees and sprinkle different seasonings on it so you get a variety of different tastes. Here's the latest on why kale is so important. It is a superfood, just like blueberries and green tea, and here's its benefit. First, it's very rich for vegans. It's very rich in high-quality, easily absorbed iron. It boosts the blood nutrients. It has vitamin K, A, and C. Very good in manganese. That's good for your heart. And copper. It's also high in fiber. That helps our digestion. It's low in calories, and there's no fat. And it improves digestion. It helps vision, it helps the heart, it's anti-inflammatory, it's a good detox, reduces cholesterol, and it can protect against cancer. So, it's just terrific. Make sure you're getting it organic, however, because kale is heavily sprayed with pesticides and chemicals, and therefore makes our dirty dozen list of the things that if you're going to eat it organic or don't eat it. And finally, a plant called the tulsi, or holy basil, which grows all over India, is able to help in defluoridating the water in poor countries. Research from the Rajasthan University had discovered that tulsi can replace some of the more expensive alternatives to fluoride removal. It's simple, so that's good. And the more we get rid of fluoride, the better it is. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to be going to our phones in a moment, and your opportunity to call in and share your thoughts, opinions, questions. Our number is 888-874-4888. I want to also mention there's so many ways that you can download this program. We have multiple sources: podbeam.com, Stitcher, S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R, Stitcher.com, TuneIn, T-U-N-E-I-N.com, AudioPort.com, PRN, FM, iTunes, all kinds of places. Plus, you can listen over the telephone, which a lot of people, more and more people are, tens and tens of thousands, 619-550-0869, 619-550-0869. Also, for all of you who packed the Woodstock Community Center on Saturday night, thank you for being there. What a terrific group of people, activists, artists, conscientious people, environmentalists, all walks of life. And I gave everyone a copy of the film, and I want to thank Randy and all the other people who volunteered to put that whole event together. And we had a meal before at a nice vegetarian restaurant there that I would certainly recommend. If you've never been to Woodstock, it's an interesting place. Take a walk. Just transport you back in time. A lot of psychedelic houses painted up. Now, this is from our environmental segment. This is from Tara Lohan, and it's called What It's Like to Have Fracking in Your Backyard. It's short, but I think it's very important at this time when more and more people are concerned about fracking. Ed Wade's property straddles the Wetzel and Marsh County lines in rural West Virginia, and it has a conventional gas well on it. Quote, you could cover the whole well pad with three pickup trucks, says Wade, and West Virginia has lots of conventional wells, more than 50,000 regular natural gas wells at last count. West Virginians are so well acquainted with gas drilling that when companies began using high-volume horizontal hydrofracking in 2006 to access the areas of the Marcellus Shale that underlie the state, most residents and regulators were unprepared for the massive footprint of the operations and the impact on their communities. When it comes to a conventional well and a Marcellus well, quote, there is no comparison, none whatsoever, says Wade, who works with the Wetzel County Action Group. Quote, you live in the country for a reason, and it just takes that and turns it upside down. You know how they preach all the time that natural gas burns cleaner than coal? Well, it may burn cleaner than coal, but it's a hell of a lot dirtier to extract. To understand what's at stake, you have to understand the vocabulary. Take the word fracking, for example. When people say it's been around since the 1950s, they're referring to vertical fracturing, or what's causing all the contention lately is a much more destructive process known as high-volume horizontal hydraulic fracturing, or they're using fracking in a very limited way. The industry uses fracking to refer just to the moment when the shell is fractured using water as the sledgehammer to shatter the shell. That's according to Sandra Steingraber, a scientist, on the issue. With that as the definition, they can say truthfully that there are no cases of water contamination associated with fracking. But you don't get fracking without bringing it with it all these other things, mining for the frack, sand, devastation, depleting water. You have to add the chemicals, you have to drill, you have to dispose of the waste, you have to drill cuttings. I refer to them all as fracking, as do most activists. Now, the potential impacts that go well beyond the moment the well is fracked are mammoth. What has been most discussed is the concern that the chemicals used in the fracking process, as well as naturally occurring but dangerous substances underground, like arsenic, heavy metals, methane, can migrate back to the surface with water through faults, fissures, and abandoned mines. That's deeply concerning, but it's just the tip of the iceberg. The footprint of the well site, which now often includes fresh water or wastewater ponds and tankers full of chemicals, has grown exponentially from the size of the conventional wells. They certainly aren't the size of a few pickup trucks. Here, in the aerial view of a new home built in rural West Virginia that is now surrounded by a fracking operation, the owner's neighborhood leased to a drilling company. Fracking takes rural communities and turns them into industrial zones. The citizens have little recourse. Thanks to the so-called Halliburton loophole in the 2005 Energy Policy Act, fracking is exempt from the Safe Water Drinking Act, and there are exemptions also to the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act. In West Virginia, a state with a long history of energy extraction, industry has a controlling hand in local and state politics, and thus far seems to be calling the shots. To make matters worse, many properties had their mineral rights separated over a century ago. So people may own their homes and properties, but not the minerals underneath, and the property can be destroyed by drilling, and they will have no financial gain. Or they can lose virtually everything, simply by living next door to someone who does lease. And a story by reporter Zach Mashdell gives a glimpse of what life is like for those people. Here's this interview with Leanna Kilner, who lives in Harrison County, West Virginia. As if the disruptions to her quality of life and property values weren't bad enough, Kilner's water well became contaminated with unsafe levels of arsenic. She came home from work one day to find that without any notice, someone working for the drilling company had disconnected her house from her well and installed a large water buffalo tank outside her home. Companies have been known to supply water tanks to affected residents temporarily and then leave the residents high and dry months or years later, even when water pollution problems persist. Water is a big and multifaceted issue when it comes to fracking. Horizontal wells in the Marcellus can take upwards of 5 million gallons of water during fracking per well. The wells can be fracked multiple times, and there can be as many as 10 wells drilled on a single well pad. Multiply that by thousands of wells that have been fracked thus far, and that's a lot of water. All those hundreds of millions of gallons are often taken from local streams and creeks. Then there's the wastewater to contend with, beginning with drilling brine, which can contain high levels of salts, as well as arsenic, mercury, chromium, and naturally occurring radioactive materials. What to do with all this wastewater? In the past, the drilling brine with the cuttings had been put in pits, and after the solids are settled, the liquid has been sprayed on the land. The West Virginia Sierra Club says, quote, if too concentrated, it kills vegetation, so even if sprayed thinly enough, not to be deadly, it cannot be helping the land. The pits with remaining solids and a plastic liner, if used, are buried on site. There's also the wastewater from the fracking process, what's called produced water, which flows from the well as it is producing. It can contain some of the toxic mix of chemicals that the companies won't tell you about. They don't remain underground. And because of the increased volume of wastewater to be disposed of from Marcellus wells, the Department of Environmental Protection is asking drillers to dispose of it by injection in underground injection wells. And much has been written about the potential risks of this process. And then people just illegally dump the water around roads. And on May 26, 2012, Christina Woods was mowing the lawn when a truck dumped water on her road for dust suppression. Christina and her husband had made numerous complaints about the road conditions since fracking operations began. At times, the dust from constant truck traffic had made it impossible for them to even open their windows or sit outdoors. After the truck went by on May 26, Christina Woods immediately got a sore throat and her tongue felt numb. They quickly realized it wasn't clean water that had been sprayed on the road. The emergency response team didn't come until 3 days later. And after the morning they did the air quality samples, it rained. The Department of Environmental Protection did find that the company JB had sprayed waste waters from natural gas production on the road and issued a fine. But water is just one of the issues for those living near fracking sites. Life itself has dramatically changed. Dinah Pitcock and her husband and son moved from near Baltimore, Maryland, to a rural haven of over 100 acres in New Milton, West Virginia, 6 years ago. Their timing could not have been worse. It is so sad because we never moved here expecting this, she said. Well, her neighbor leased his property to one of these fracking companies, and now the Pitcocks, a land abuts a drilling site known as the Ruckman Well Pad, and it's four separate well pads on the land, having 27 individual permits for horizontal legs. In July, the forest at her property border was so thick you couldn't see the sky. 3 weeks later, the forest has been cleared with earth movers, and much of it burned in massive piles. And then it goes on from there. Operations go around the clock, 24/7. Constant noise, lights, and air pollution. The cornerstone of the industrial relation that comes with fracking is that all the truck traffic, hundreds of trucks a day, travel on county roads, never built for large trucks with the amount of wear and tear. Accidents are common, and that's the way it is. So that's just one of the reasons why, by the way, I believe that we should be paying attention to this, because otherwise we're getting nailed. I'm Gary Knoll. We're here to talk about the issues that make a difference in our lives. One of our commentaries today, and then we'll take your calls. This is from Norman Solomon from Global Research. It's entitled The Orwellian Warfare State of Carnage and Doublethink. I'm interested in your thoughts on this. I'll quote him verbatim. It's short. After the bombings that killed and maimed so horribly at the Boston Marathon, our country's politics and mass media are awash in heartfelt compassion and reflective doublethink, which George Orwell described as willingness to forget any fact that has become inconvenient. In sync with media outlets across the country, the New York Times put a chilling headline on front page, Boston bombs were loaded to maim, officials say. The story reported that nails and ball bearings were stuffed into pressure cookers, rigged to shoot sharp bits of shrapnel into anyone within reach of their blast. Much less crude and weighing in at 1,000 pounds, GBU-87B warheads were in the category of, quote, combined effects munitions when put to use 14 years ago by a bomber named Uncle Sam. The U.S. media coverage was brief and fleeting. On Friday at noontime, U.S.-led NATO forces dropped cluster bombs on the city of Nice in the vicinity of a vegetable market. Quote, the bomb struck next to the hospital complex near the market, bringing death and destruction, peppering the streets of Serbia's third-largest city with shrapnel. That's according to the San Francisco Chronicle on May 8, 1999. Quote, and in a street leading from the market, dismembered bodies were strewn among carrots and other vegetables and pools of blood. A dead woman, her body covered with a sheet, was still clutching a shopping bag filled with carrots. End quote. Pointing out that cluster bombs, quote, explode in the air and hurl shards of shrapnel over a wide radius, BBC correspondent John Simpson wrote in the Sunday Telegraph, quote, used against human beings, cluster bombs are some of the most savage weapons of modern warfare, end quote. Savage did not preclude usage. As a matter of fact, the commander-in-chief, Bill Clinton, and the prevailing military minds in Washington, savage was bound up in the positive attributes of cluster bombs. Each one could send up to 60,000 pieces of jaded steel shrapnel into what the weapons maker described as, quote, soft targets, i.e. human bodies. An unusually diligent reporter, Paul Watson of the Los Angeles Times, reported from Pristina, Yugoslavia, quote, during 5 weeks of airstrike, witnesses here say NATO warplanes have dropped cluster bombs that scatter smaller munitions over wide areas. In military jargon, the smaller munitions are bomblets, Dr. Rabe Grip, a surgeon director at Pristina's main hospital, sees proof every day that the almost benign term bomblet masks a tragic impact. He saw the lives of two ethnic Albanian boys wounded while other boys played with a cluster bomb found Saturday. Said he had never done so many amputations. The Los Angeles Times article quoted him, quote, I have been an orthopedist for 15 years now, working in a crisis region where we often have injuries, but neither I nor my colleagues have ever seen such horrific wounds as those caused by cluster bombs. They are wounds that lead to disabilities to a great extent. The limbs are so crushed that the only remaining option is amputation. It is awful, absolutely awful. The newspaper account went on, Pristina's hospital alone treated 400 people wounded by cluster bombs since NATO's air war began. The doctor said roughly half of those victims were civilians. Because that number doesn't include those killed by cluster bombs and doesn't account for those wounded in other regions of Yugoslavia, the casualty toll is much, much higher. Quote, most people were victims of the time-activated cluster bombs that explode sometime after they fall. Later, during invasions and initial periods of occupation, the U.S. military dropped cluster bombs in Afghanistan and fired cluster munitions in Iraq. Today, the U.S. State Department remains opposed to outlawing those weapons, declaring on its official website, quote, cluster munitions have demonstrated military utility. Their elimination from the U.S. stockpiles would put the lives of its soldiers and those of its coalition partners at risk, end quote. The State Department's position as, quote, moreover, cluster munitions can often result in much less collateral damage than unitary weapons. Perhaps the bomber who stuffed nails and ball bearings into pressure cookers for use in Boston had a twisted rationale equal to that. But don't expect explorations of such matters in USA's daily papers or commercial networks or NPR's Morning Edition or All Things Considered or PBS's NewsHour. When the subject is killing and maiming, such news outlets take as a given the presumption moral high ground of the U.S. government. In his novel, 1984, Orwell wrote about the conditioned reflex of, quote, stopping short as though by instinct, at the threshold of any dangerous thought, and of being bored or repelled by any train of thought which is capable of leading in a heretical direction. The doublethink continually reinforced by mass media remains within an irony-free zone that would amount to mere self-satire if not so damaging to intellectual moral coherence. Every news report about the children killed and injured at the finish line in Boston, every account of the horrific loss of limbs makes me think of the little girl named Jomia. She was 7 years old when I first met her at an Afghan refugee camp one day in the summer 2009. At the time I wrote, quote, she talked about what happened one morning last year when she was sleeping at home in southern Afghanistan's Helmand Valley. At about 5 a.m., bombs exploded. Some people in her family died. She lost an arm. In the refugee camp on the outskirts of Kabul, where several hundred families were living in squalid condition, the U.S. government was providing no help. The last time she and her father had meaningful contact with the U.S. government was when it bombed them. War thrives on abstractions. But for her, there was no abstraction. She was no more or no less an abstraction than the children whose lives had been forever wrecked by the bombing at the Boston finish line. But the same U.S. news media that are convening the issue of the preciousness of children so terribly harmed in Boston are not to be found for all the other children. I thought of her again when seeing news reports in a chilling photo soon after 11 children in eastern Afghanistan were unlucky in where they were. Those children died from a U.S. NATO airstrike. For mainland American journalists, it wasn't much of a story. For American officials, it was no big deal. Quote, circus dogs jump when the trainer craps his whip. Orwell observed, but the really well-trained dog is the one that runs his somersault when there is no whip. End quote. Norman Solomon, his words, your thoughts. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. That irony to today. Wasn't it President Obama who did drugs? Yeah. And Clinton? Yeah. And Bush? They all did. Okay. That's their right. But does the average American ever stop and ask, what is the actual cost? The war on drugs? It's a complete fraud. Like all of our wars, they're frauds. This is just the latest. Quote, President Barack Obama's drug czar has spoken out against recently passed state laws in Colorado and Washington condemning legislation that legalized the possession of marijuana in small amounts. The director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy told an audience in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday that the Obama administration does not plan on honoring new state laws that let millions of adults in Colorado and Washington legally smoke. Okay. Well, then, how about this? Would the drug czar have arrested or arrest President Obama or Clinton or all the other politicians for smoking the same amount of marijuana that they believe you should be in prison now for 15 years? How many politicians would be left on the streets? There is nothing but irony in this insanity. From Countercurrents, from Chingu. This is short, but and then I'll go to your calls. Just that there are good dictators and bad dictators. In Washington's eyes, there are also good terrorists and bad terrorists. Al-Qaeda in Iraq, bad. Al-Qaeda in Syria, good. Al-Qaeda in Mali, bad. Al-Qaeda in Libya, good. But now bad. This hypocrisy manifests itself acutely in how Western media reports on the victims of terror. On the same day as the recent Boston bombings, at least 75 people were killed in Iraq and more than 250 injured by a series of car bombs. Al-Qaeda in Iraq has claimed responsibility for the car bombings, and within minutes of the bombings in Boston, Western media outlets, politicians, and security experts all hastily concluded that Islamic terrorists was to blame. Well, the FBI says only 6% of terror attacks in the United States are by Muslims. In fact, Jewish extremists committed more terror attacks in the U.S. than Muslims over the last 30 years. Yet notice the disparity in media coverage between the two. Muslims constitute 1% of the U.S. population, but they are 13% of the victims of religious-based hate crimes. Clearly, Muslims at home and abroad are disproportionately the victims of terrorism. Yet in the media, there is an outpouring of rage and condemnation whenever Western citizens are killed, while reports of more frequent Muslim deaths are muted. In the Western media, there would appear to be a distinct hierarchy of human life. America's policy of openly backing Islamic terrorist groups stems largely from the Cold War era. Back then, America saw the world in rather simple terms. On one side, the Soviet Union and Third World nationalism, which America regarded as a Soviet tool. On the other side, Western nations and militant political Islam, which America considered an ally in the struggle against the Soviet Union. The director of the National Security Agency under Ronald Reagan, General William Odom, recently remarked, quote, by any measure, the United States has long used terrorism. In 78 and 79, the Senate was trying to pass a law against international terrorism. In every version they produced, the lawyers said the U.S. would be in violation, end quote. The CIA used the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt as a barrier both to Soviet expansion and to the spread of Marxist ideology among the Arab masses. The United States also openly supported the Islam groups against Sukarno in Indonesia and also Ali Bhutto in Pakistan. Last but certainly not least, there's Al-Qaeda. Lest we forget, bin Laden was trained, armed, and funded by the CIA. Former British Foreign Secretary Robin Cook admitted, quote, Al-Qaeda, literally the database, was originally the computer file of the thousands of Mujahideen who were recruited and trained with help of the CIA to defeat the Russians. America's relationship with Al-Qaeda has always been a love-hate affair, depending upon whether a terrorist group is in a given region furthers America's interests or not. The State Department either funds or aggressively targets that terrorist group, typically with drones. American anti-terrorist operations and drones are reported to have killed at least 4,700 people, the vast majority of whom are innocent men and women and children. For every innocent civilian killed by an American drone strike, there are hundreds of grieving relatives that will inevitably resent America, any number of whom may turn to militant Islam and terrorism. Truth is, America's anti-terrorism operations are only creating more anti-American terrorists. The best that force can do is to impose order. It can never elicit harmony. Therefore, war on terror is flawed in theory and disastrous in practice. The war on terror has made Al-Qaeda much stronger than it was on 9/11. In fact, the more Washington emphasizes war and confrontation, the more it silences moderate voices in the Muslim world who want to speak up for cooperation. Quite aside from creating more terrorists than it kills, America's war on terror also has the unintended consequences of slowly but surely bankrupting the nation. Terrorist attacks on U.S. soil embolden the right-wing elements of the military-industrial complex, and the resulting military actions by these right-wing elements embolden terrorists further. It is this vicious cycle of war and terror that future historians may well consider to be one of the key elements that precipitated the decline of the great capitalist American empire. Adam Smith, the grandfather of capitalism, was a staunch anti-imperialist. He argued that imperialism is costly and eventually bankrupts the country. In fact, one year, the U.S. military budget is equal to more than $20,000 per hour for every hour since Jesus was born. The monumental expansion of U.S. military bases across the globe in the name of counterterrorism illustrates the degree to which America's treasury is being overstretched by the military-industrial elite who commander the purse strings. As William Blum has pointed out, following the bombing of Iraq, the U.S. would wound up with military bases in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, Oman, and the United Emirates. Following the bombing of Yugoslavia, the U.S. wound up with military bases in Hungary, Macedonia, Bosnia, Croatia, Kosovo, and Albania. Following the recent bombings of Afghanistan, the U.S. is now winding up with bases in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan. Much like late-stage Rome and the barbarians, Washington is overreaching, overstretching itself in the name of terrorists. And like Rome, the hubris of Washington's politicians and the gung-ho nature of its generals are threatening the empire. And Professor Jingu is a fellow of Harvard University's Du Bois Institute for African Research. Let's say hello to our callers. Let's say hello to, who do we have up here? Harvey from Berkeley. Harvey, your turn.
Hi, Gary. Well, I'd like to add to your conversation on fracking. And, well, the U.S. Army and United States Geological Survey both have stated that fracking causes earthquakes and that fracking lubricates the fault lines. Well, where I live in California, it's earthquake country, and we're always being warned that the big one is coming. We're always told to put water and food aside. The big one. The big one is a megathrust earthquake that's about 9 point on the Richter scale, like the one that that took Fukushima down. And the thing is that they want to now frack the Monterey Shale. And in front of the Monterey Shale is the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant that is only designed to withstand a 7.5 shock. Otherwise, we'll have a nuclear meltdown there too, and it'll be another nuclear disaster. And so I feel that fracking could cause a nuclear meltdown, and the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant sits directly in front of the California Central Growing Valley, where 25% of the food that goes across American tables comes from, plus the water flows from the Sierra Nevada Mountains through the Central Valley into cities from San Francisco to L.A. Millions and millions of people drink that water. If all that food and water becomes irradiated from nuclear meltdown, because these nuclear clouds go up and they blow inland, these radioactive clouds, and that'll be the end of California. It'll be the end of the Central Valley. It'll be the end of food. And with the recently we had that drought in the corn drought, and so if we lose the Central Valley to a nuclear accident, as well as losing the corn this year or last year to drought, I mean, this could really damage America. So fracking could be the end of America in that sense. It could create a nuclear meltdown.
I absolutely agree with you. Your points are well taken, and thank you very much, Harvey, for calling in from Berkeley, California. Let's go over and say hello to Elaine from Michigan. Hi, Elaine. Where in Michigan are you?
I'm in Livonia, Michigan.
Nice to have you with us today. How can I help you?
I would like to know if you could suggest some nutrients that I could take to combat the side effects of asthma inhalers.
Well, top of my list would be organic flaxseed oil, a teaspoon in the morning, a teaspoon in the evening. Also, black cumin seed oil, a teaspoon in the morning, a teaspoon in the evening.
Okay.
Also, primrose oil, once a day in the morning. I would then use 50 milligrams of pentothenic acid twice a day. Pentothenic acid is B5. Have you heard of quercetin?
Yes, actually, I do have some of that at my home.
All right. Well, I would use the bioactive quercetin.
Bioactive.
Bioactive quercetin. I would use 1,000 milligrams four times a day. It's a powerful immunostimulant, and it's an antihistamine. And that's what you want. It stops the cells from being inflamed.
Okay.
Also, vitamin A, about 15,000 units a day. And I would also use vitamin C, a buffered form of vitamin C, generally 1,000 milligrams six times a day.
Okay.
Mixed tocotrienols and tocopherols and bromelain and L-cysteine and methionine. And that's a good way to get started, all right?
Okay, thank you very much for your help.
All the best to you.
Thank you, Gary.
Let's
Bye.
Say hello to Megan from New Jersey. Hi, Megan. Hi, Megan, you're on the air. Speak up.
Hi, Gary, how are you?
Good.
I have to have a question. What are your thoughts on USDA organic? That seems to be the most pressing or the most available organic that we can buy in our local supermarket.
Well, it's okay, but remember, those of us who are organic farmers are constantly putting our 2 cents in there. You should also look at the official organic organizations, and you can do that by going to my website or any website and looking up the Organic Farmers Association, and there are over 275,000 farmers who are affiliated with it or have signed petitions on behalf of it, and we have better standards than the USDA. All right, our standards are higher. The USDA would love to use irradiated food, genetically modified food, and industrial and human sludge. So they're easily compromised, but go to the state. The state is better. All right?
Okay. Thank you.
All the best to you.
You too. Thank you.
And let's say hello to Anne from New Jersey. Hi, Anne.
Thank you, Gary. I've been listening to you for a while, and I've finally decided to actualize what you preach, and I have started to do that. But the last thing, I'm on a sleeping pill, a mild one, and I want to get off of it, and I am going to get off of it. My question to you is, I heard you once say that taking a prescription sleeping pill every day is equal in detriment to smoking a pack of cigarettes a day. And I'd just like you to tell me, in what way is it detrimental?
No, you didn't hear me say that. What I said is going out for a long run was equal in the free radical attacks against the cell through oxidative stress as smoking a pack of cigarettes, but without the chemicals, without the tars and the 200 chemicals. It had nothing to do with sleeping. It's just you've juxtapositioned two statements. Just like when I recently mentioned, taking a sleeping medication is not the same as smoking cigarettes. What sleeping medication does is completely separate. As you see, one of the side effects is it adversely affects the melatonin in the brain. It can adversely affect your focus, your balance. It can even lead to death. So I'm not a supporter at all of sleeping pills. By the way, the other day I mentioned that one of the reasons I wanted countries like Greece and Spain and Portugal and Latvia and Ireland to go off the euro is so that they can establish once again their own currency like Great Britain and the pound. Now, there are 27 countries in the euro zone. There are 17 using the euro as a currency, but Great Britain uses the pound sterling. It has its own money. But other countries can't go borrow money when they need it. You cannot, as individual countries, print more euros. You can't do that. And therefore, if you have your own currency, you can negotiate your debt. You can forgive debt. And why isn't anyone asking when Cyprus had to come up with, you know, $15 billion? Where does that money go? When you're paying back a debt, like the Greeks are now going to have 25,000 of their civil servants fired without pension. Where does that money go, that austerity money go? Does it go to the Greek government? Does it go to social programs? Does it go to help people? No, it does not. It goes back to the banks. Well, didn't they make the mistake originally? Yes. So I believe that we should be looking at ways that all the countries can get off the euro, reestablish their own currency, go through a period of rebalancing their own currency, and start re-energizing. Austerity measures do not rebalance an economy. They destroy an economy. Now, I hope that makes a point that I was making the other day. We're up to the end of our program, and I want to thank people for calling in and listening. By the way, a powerful program tonight. You won't want to miss it on the Progressive Commentary Hour at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where we're going to take on the media for its biases and what it doesn't report. Now we'll take a few more calls of people who are out there. Anna from Florida. Hi, Anna.
Hi, Gary. Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions. One is from your travels around the world and doing a movie about the 13 tipping points. What's your point on shifting of the poles?
The pole shifting, I have looked at carefully as I every day I look at all of the information on earthquakes, volcanic eruptions. This is all up on the internet. You can see it in good quality sites, and I have not seen that at a point where I would consider that one of the 12 tipping points. There are other points that are tipping now that have actually tipped that are far more important to our well-being. Okay, all the best to you. Thank you. Our final caller today is Lou Ann Panessi. Hi, Lou Ann.
Hey. I've gotten an email, and I'm sure you've seen this on the news, talk about the media. About 2 or 3 years ago, you spoke about the fact that we're going to have a lot more violent crimes happening in the suburbs, and I'm on Long Island, as many people are, and the other suburbs around the area and all around the country. And we're seeing more and more. There was a recent article about the fact that a place in a very quiet, cozy little neighborhood in Queens where someone broke into the house at 4 o'clock in the morning, bound and gagged a 7-year-old and a 10-year-old, as well as the husband and wife, and put them in a closet, in different closets, and told them to count backwards from 100, and then went ahead and ransacked everything in their home. And, you know, I don't know that people really would believe that this stuff could happen in these so-called, you know, safe neighborhoods. And I guess I just wanted to hear your thoughts on it, because it's happening more and more and more.
You have to look at it in a reverse fashion. When a society is prosperous, when people have taken care of their basic needs, their mortgage or rent, their utilities, their food, clothing, school, and have still enough left over to support their local economy, going to a movie, a play, going out, going shopping, then you have a very low effect when it comes to crime. When you have a lot of unemployed people, especially teenagers, and many of these teenagers see that their homes are gone, their quality of life has been destroyed, and they don't see an opportunity for themselves in the future, that's when they're susceptible to being recruited into gangs. The gang movement in America today is just like a tap left open. It is flowing. And the gangs know that historically they could only succeed in ghettos. But America didn't care, unfortunately, and with great insensitivity. As long as you were in a ghetto, you were considered fair game, I guess, or your relevance and value were not the same as a person who was not in a ghetto. That's why, for example, I was abhorred at how the media handled the false case against the five who were later found to be innocent in the Central Park mugging and raping. I asked at the time how many of those individuals would have been as equally interested to know that there were 29 Latino and African-American women raped and beaten that no one paid any attention to. So now crime is happening in those suburbs. Now it's happening in homes that are not ghettoized. And that's just the beginning. You will see an epidemic of homes that are going to be vandalized, or where robberies are going to occur in the daytime, where people are going to be, one of the couples will be kept at home with an intruder with a gun to their head, and another will be taken to a bank and funds withdrawn or an ATM machine. All their valuables are going to be looted. This is the future. It's only going to get worse. I'm guesstimating that we're going to see about 5 million gang members over the next 5 years in the United States. And if you don't live in a safe zone or gated community, you're going to be fair game. It's not going to get better. It's only going to get worse. Now, we've been having gangs, we've been having crimes for a long time. But as long as it was in someone else's neighborhood and against a different ethnicity, we didn't pay attention. Gee whiz, what lessons we should learn. Thanks for your call. Let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we're talking about the FBI and homegrown terrorism.
Now, are you going in the closet to talk about them? Are they in your closet waiting for you?
No, actually, I'm sharing my closet today with fellow broadcaster Stephen Lendman.
Great.
Of the Progressive Radio Network News Hour.
Good. We look forward to it coming up right now. Please stay with us.